since 1775,
generations of Americans have fought
for our ideals and our principles.
American warriors secured the freedoms to create the United States of America.
They fought to end slavery.
They joined with allies to win two world wars.
They have responded with valor and honor whenever called. And they have liberated more people around the globe than any military in the history of the world.
Our all-volunteer forces of guardsmen,
soldiers,
sailors,
marines,
airmen, and reservists continue the mission begun
at Lexington and Concord.
Less than 1% of Americans serve in our armed forces.
The least the rest of us can do is to pay attention and get engaged.
This program is produced and broadcast for that purpose.
It is presented live and worldwide at 1041thetruth.com.
To engage, call 520-751-1041.
The American Warrior is on the air.
Good afternoon, Tucson. This is Ben Bueller Garcia, your host here on American Warrior. Welcome back. Hope you listened to Fred and Jeff. They had a great show on just earlier this morning. Welcome to 2014. Gosh, it's that time of year where we all have to start remembering what to write on the checks. Do you still use checks anymore, Jim? You're telling me you're like an all-electronic guy anymore? No? No checks. Okay. Folks, Jim is the most exciting person ever. I got to tell you that. Hey, listen, we have got I'll tell you, it's going to be a great show here on American Warrior, but not necessarily a happy, happy show. Very often when we talk on American Warrior with our guests, we're talking about the men and women of the military and those who support them. And I also want to emphasize on occasion the fact that the people in our military also support others. It's not always about, you know, breaking windows and dropping bombs. And some of you, hopefully, unless you've been in a cave, you remember that we had probably one of the deadliest typhoons on record hit the Philippines, among other locations, back in November. 196-mile-an-hour sustained winds, gusts up over 200 miles an hour, the end result being an estimated 4 million people dislocated. Now, ladies and gentlemen, there are 24 U.S. states that have less than 4 million people in them. So if you can imagine an entire U.S. state suddenly finding themselves being dislocated, we're going to be talking about Typhoon Haiyan or Yolanda with our guest who, if you're a regular listener to American Warrior, you probably recognize her name. It seems like any time there's help needed in the world, Major Stacy Shaffron is there. Stacy, welcome to American Warrior.
Hey, thanks, Ben. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you, too. Now, you're calling us today from what spot on the globe?
I'm in Virginia.
You said, ugh, I'm in Virginia. What's the temperature out there today, Stacy?
Oh, it's chilly. There's snow, and it's starting to sleet. So definitely a contrast to Tucson weather, I'm sure.
Well, welcome back, Stacy. And for folks who haven't heard Stacy on before, she is obviously with the United States Air Force. She was commissioned through the ROTC program at the University of Colorado Boulder, which I hear has just started a football program. She has her BS in broadcast news journalism, master's degree in business administration, 2 combat tours supporting Operation Enduring Freedom, and 1 supporting Operation Iraqi Freedom. For a while there, Stacy, you were the senior Air Force public affairs officer in Iraq?
I was, yeah. I was there the last 6 months of 2011, and it was a big honor just to be over there and help close down our mission and bring our airmen home and watch the transition happen.
And speaking of the differences in temperature, for a while there, you were the chief of the 355th Fighter Wing Public Affairs right here in little old Tucson.
I was, yes, a few years ago. I missed that job. It was a great job.
Yeah, you missed the weather. And you're probably, if I'm not mistaken, you were the first Davis-Monthan airman to be selected for the 40 Under 40 program, or award, I should say.
You know, I'm not sure about that, but that was also an honor. Good memory for my time in Tucson.
Now, you know, Stacy, when I was selected, it was called the 30 Under 30 because, you know, way back then the life expectancy was only 40 years.
We had to raise the bar.
So, right, Stacy, you're now with U.S. Transcom, the Joint Enabling Capabilities Command, and tell us about what U.S. Transcom is and what they do.
Well, the unit that I'm working for, the Joint Enabling Capabilities Command, it falls under U.S. Transcom, and we're geographically separated from Transcom. They're based in Missouri, and I work in Norfolk, Virginia. And the JEC has a pretty fascinating mission. It is a unit that provides tailored packages of joint capability, so all of the services, and we can go support wherever the Department of Defense needs us in a quick, timely manner. So it was perfect when the super typhoon hit, we were able to get some people out the door within days and get over there and help assist.
Now, I find that very interesting because so often those of us who are on the outside, if you will, think strictly in terms of Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, Coast Guard. But TRANSCOM is really, it's a unified, functional, unified command, correct, that supports all the branches as well as some other United States government agencies?
Yep, that's correct. It's all the services, and that's what makes this assignment so unique for me is that it's a joint assignment. So in my public affairs offices, I work alongside all of the services, and we're able to go out and do this joint mission. So when we went to the Philippines, we actually set up Joint Task Force 505, and it was comprised of all of the services.
Now, if
working
I'm
side by side,
if I'm not mistaken, TRANSCOM itself sort of evolved from a recognition that there was a need for not only better coordination and support, but also to save money. And I think the organization is saving us millions of dollars, or more than that, maybe just from looking at the website.
That's definitely the goal, especially in this day and age where our budget is getting smaller and smaller by the day.
And you also have commercial partners involved, if I'm not mistaken, the Civil Reserve Air Fleet, and then something called the Voluntary Intermodal Sea Lift Agreement. What can you tell us about those guys?
I've used those in the past. Like when we came home from Iraq a couple years ago, we did reach into those other commercial sectors, and they help bring our personnel home. So when we need it, we're able to rely on our civilian counterparts and help facilitate the mission.
Now, you hear the UPS ads about logistics, and looking at what you guys are and what you do, I mean, you are the definition of logistics. You got, again, off your website, any given week, you've got 1,900 air missions going, 25 ships underway, and over 10,000 ground shipments. You're working in over 75% of the world across the globe. Is that just another day in the week for Stacy Shaffron?
Well, I don't do all of those things, Ben, but all of the great men and women that comprise our Department of Defense are part of that mission, making it happen all over the globe.
And when we talk about logistics, TRANSCOM stands for, in civilian terms?
Yep, it's the United States Transportation Command.
Okay, so you're moving stuff from point A to point B or C or D. What?
Yep, it provides support to the 8 other U.S. combatant commands, and so it's busy and it has a hand in everything that's going on.
Now, when you're transporting, it's not just personnel, correct? It's cargo.
Right. It's supplies. It's whatever's got to be moved. Personnel and equipment.
Now, is it something? Let's say if I'm Major Shaffron and I get promoted to Colonel Shaffron and I have to move my housing, my stuff from my home, is that? Would that fall under you guys as well, or one of your private contractors? It just depends.
It just depends.
Okay. And do you also, are you involved in transporting the remains of some of our military?
They have different missions to do that. We have the personnel that go into Dover Air Force Base here on the East Coast.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a fascinating mission. There's a lot that goes on. And I'm pretty new to the command, so I'm still learning about the fascinating stuff that we're doing and all the unique missions.
You didn't know there'd be a quiz, did you, Stacy?
With you, I'm always ready. I'm always prepared.
Well, let's talk about last time we had you on American Warrior, you were discussing your mission in Afghanistan and going out and working with some of the outlying communities is sort of maybe that's got a whole different perspective in Afghanistan, but actually getting out with the locals and trying to get some programs started. And that's why I said when I started off the program, it seems like when there's a need, when there's a public affair need anywhere around the world, you're there. And just recently, so on November 15th, you were part of a 12-person team that deployed to the Philippines. Tell us about that.
I was. I actually went with 5 other people from my joint public affairs office in Norfolk, and we had about a day and a half, 2 days to get ready and get out the door. And we headed over to Manila, and we were there for a couple of weeks, and we were part of the group that set up the joint task force.
Okay. Listen, we're going to take a commercial break. We'd like to come back and talk to you more about this. Folks, this typhoon, something out of a Greek tragedy, except for very, very real and unfortunate. But our military, the United States Air Force in this case, we're there to help our fellow human beings out. Stick around. We'll be back on American Warrior.
Those who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior.
We're back on American Warrior. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking today about our military and how they step up to help others around the world, not just securing people's freedoms. And I guess it's kind of appropriate. We did have an advertisement for the Marines, but our guest, Major Stacy Shaffron, works for a joint command, so she interacts with the Marines in addition to, she's Air Force, but she works for the Marines and the Navy and the Coast Guard and the Army, all those folks. So Stacy, welcome back. We were talking about Super Typhoon Haiyan and Yolanda, the deadliest Philippine typhoon on record. As I mentioned before the break, when we start off, this typhoon reached sustained winds of up to 196 mile an hour, and that's just hard to even fathom in my brain, something moving that fast. And of course, I saw from some research that a lot of the injuries and the deaths were as a result of those high force winds actually moving stuff at a high speed and hitting and killing people. What, 6,166 dead, 28,000 injured, 1,785 missing, over $827 million in damages. Stacy, so you were talking before the break, you were part of a team that had a couple days' notice and were dispatched. You landed in Manila, and take the story from there.
Yep. So we got there and immediately just started coordinating to form the task force prior to our arrival. The Marines were actually there on the ground. They arrived from Okinawa, and they were coordinating the effort.
So they were the first of our branches to be on the ground there on site?
They were one of the first.
Okay.
You know, we also had an Air Force unit that came from Guam, and they came over to help try to fix the runways and get the airports functional again.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you can imagine, pretty much everything, it was wiped out. So
was that an engineering squadron or a Red Horse?
It was an engineering unit.
Okay.
It was actually had a really a pretty great mission. They came from Anderson Air Force Base in Guam. It was the 36th Contingency Response Group.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And, yep, they were airmen that were able to help set up the airfields so that way they could handle aircraft such as the C-17s that were bringing in equipment and helping evacuate the survivors.
Now, I noticed that, again, that one of your organization's specialty is communication. And
mm-hmm.
so often, we, you know, our daily lives, we've got the radio, we've got the phone, we've got a cell phone, we've got the internet, we've got all these toys, and we just take for granted. But one of the issues right off the bat, I suspect, over there was people just couldn't talk to each other. And we're not just talking about, you know, a mother looking for her children, but, I mean, the government agencies themselves could not communicate because of the power of the typhoon and the infrastructure that it wiped out.
Yep, that is true. We actually took with us a communications unit, and they came from Florida, from MacDill Air Force Base, and they brought all of the communication equipment that we would need to set up in an area where there was nothing available. And we had probably some of the best capability because of that. But otherwise, it was a struggle just to make that happen. We were operating out of the Philippine Air Force Base in Manila, so we had some of their resources too. But in areas like Tacloban, where it was decimated, I mean, you just couldn't do that unless you had the remote capability to do that.
You know, when I talk about it being something out of a Greek tragedy, you just look at the sheer numbers of the suffering and the human misery. But then there's things that just make you shake your head. Cebu and Bohol, that area had a 7.2 strength earthquake just 2 weeks prior to the typhoon hitting. So they were already reeling when this thing swept through. And then you mentioned Tacloban. That, as I understand it, the convention center there was organized and set up as an evacuation center. But then the storm surge came in there and wiped out the entire first floor. And there were people who survived the typhoon itself, and then they're sitting there in this evacuation center, and then they've got to struggle to survive once again because the whole the first floor is getting flooded.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There was, everything was just gone. Our personnel who were down there working, where they set up tents, and it was an austere location for them. And, you know, people just took cover wherever they could. And those that wanted to be evacuated, we helped do that. And those that wanted to stay and start their rebuilding, you know, they stayed to do that. And, you know, part of the mission, what I was there to do, was help tell the story. So we were there facilitating the media that came in, and, you know, just to get them out into areas like Tacloban, or to go aboard the helicopters that were delivering the aid, just to be out there to tell the stories and get those photographs and that video imagery.
Now, Stacy, had you been in the Philippines prior to this?
No, I had never
okay,
been.
Okay, so you had no before and after comparison.
No.
Okay.
So, and I was in Manila, too, and they were, aside for some rainfall, there wasn't the devastation that happened in, you know, like Cebu or in Tacloban.
So when you, I said some of the first groups in, the Marines, you talked about the Air Force in there. How soon, given your particular area of expertise, then how soon thereafter does the general, assuming you said you talk about facilitating media, you're not just talking about military communications, but the commercial media as well, CNN, those kinds of folks. How soon do they come flowing in?
They get there, you know, as quick as they can, because that's the breaking news. So they have their agencies and their bureaus set up in around the globe, and so they were there on the ground. I was there about a week after the incident happened, and there was still a pretty strong media presence at that point. But in the days before we arrived, the Marine Public Affairs team, they were actually helping coordinate and facilitate the media. And there was like 40 to 60 media that were there before
Wow.
we arrived. And, you know, it was just kind of this free-for-all. Just the media, civilian media, had to, you know, fend for themselves. And, you know, they're used to doing that. They can hop on an aircraft and go and help tell the story. And so, you know, once my unit got there, we were able to help organize it a little bit better and, you know, pitch specific stories. But, you know, my line of work, you have to get there quickly and be able to tell the story as it's happening, because, you know, starting a week or two into it, the news interest starts to taper a bit.
How, given your experience in situations like this, how important is it to have the facts straight? I think in a tragedy like this, oftentimes the tragedy can be compounded by people propagating mm-hmm. incorrect information. Did you see that? I know you had 7 days before mm-hmm. you got there. Was that an issue in this case, or?
Well, I mean, I remember when it first happened, and we were watching the news reports, and they were initially saying there's 10,000 people who have been killed, and the number's climbing. And I just remember watching the TV, and it's just shocking to think 10,000 people. You know, that's a huge number. And so when I actually got there, I just didn't know what to expect. And you know, thankfully, the number was a little bit lower, but it's still, I mean, the 5,000 to 6,000 that died, it's just a true tragedy. It was definitely very sad.
Well, and I personal experience with that, and obviously not on the same scale, but years ago, I was out of town when I was at the University of Arizona when the big floods hit here in Tucson. And so we're in San Francisco watching the TV, and it looked like Tucson was gone. I mean, the houses washing into the river, and we didn't know what to expect when we get back. And when we looked around, well, that was the only house that washed into the river. Everything else is just perfectly normal. So I can imagine on, you know, scale 1,000-fold. When you're, describe to us what that process is. Did you have journalists embedded like you did during the war, or they pretty much, like you said, were doing their own thing and you were just there to help facilitate, or all of the above?
It was, you know, once we got there, we were able to link up with whatever media was still there on the ground, and we couldn't really embed any media because everybody was moving so quick. You know, the name of the game in that operation is just to be able to deliver the relief supplies quickly to the people in need. So if we could get some seats on an aircraft that was going out, we would, you know, advertise it and get the media out there to go. So it was, you know, it was a little bit different than my time in Afghanistan in the sense that this was so quick. You know, everything changed. The mission changed throughout the course of the day over the couple of weeks that we were there. And it was either you take the moment or you're going to miss it. So, you know, it was good. They kept the media on their toes. And I think we got some pretty decent coverage out of the out of the operation.
And how do you gauge that, Stacy? Is it just the number of stories that appear, or the value of the return on those stories, the amount of aid that begins flowing in, or is there a way to, what are the metrics involved in your mission?
There's a lot that goes into that. The aid was already, it was already there. The lead federal agency for this, was the Department of State USAID. And so we were there to support them. And the aid was already there flowing. So, you know, an interesting aspect of this operation was actually working with all of the other agencies. So in addition to the joint military effort, we were there working with Department of State, USAID, and other U.S. agencies and NGOs. And I thought that was actually really fascinating, just to be able to see all of these groups pull together.
So you can put cat herder on your resume.
I can. And in addition to this, you know, there were so many other countries that were there too. I mean, just to go out and stand on the airfield, aircraft from Japan and Australia and so many different countries that they just came. You know, people, there were so many stories of people from other countries, medical workers, volunteers, people who were on their vacation in the Philippines
Stacy, I want to hear some of those stories. If you don't mind, after the break, we're going to take a break for the news. Folks, we're talking to Major Stacy Shaffron, who's talking about her experiences involved in the restoration or the salvation effort, if you will, of Super Typhoon Haiyan and Yolanda in the Philippines. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia, American Warrior. We'll be right back.
Who expect to reap the blessings of freedom must, like men, undergo the fatigue of supporting it. Now, back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
Welcome back to the second half of American Warrior. I tell you, I will stand corrected when I make a mistake. We don't play the news at the bottom of the hour anymore. Jim just told me, just the weather. But, you know, in Tucson, it's the weather. Look outside. How hard can it be? So welcome back. We're with Stacy Shaffron, Major Stacy Shaffron, who's telling us about her experiences involving the Super Typhoon Haiyan and Yolanda, and her deployment as part of a joint command was over there to help facilitate the communications following that tragedy. Stacy, welcome back. And you, just before we took the break, you were telling us just about all the moving parts involved, not just the different branches of the military, but different countries, the State Department. Lots of moving parts in this, and you said that, you know, you mentioned particularly a Japanese group and some of the specific stories you saw or heard. Tell us about some of those, if you don't mind.
I was very fascinated by the international effort that was underway. So we worked out of a little tiny makeshift office at the Philippine Air Force Base, and so we could hear the aircraft coming and going, the ones that were dropping off supplies, and also bringing the survivors, the ones that were evacuated. And there were numerous aircraft from different countries, such as Japan. And it was this neat opportunity because we were able to bring the media by. There were Japanese media, too, and they wanted to cover what their country was doing, you know, for example. And there was a communication barrier per se, but it was really, really hot when we were there too, and very humid. And so, you know, add to that the temperatures, as Tucson is familiar. You know, the airmen who were out there working on the A-10s and the aircraft there in Tucson, working on the fly line it's very hot, and the same for these crews. And it was, you know, everybody was just out there with a good attitude, no matter what country they came from and what their mission was. I thought that was very positive. People didn't complain, and they just kept working and kept doing whatever they could. And we didn't have much to give. And, you know, I walked by, and I remember having an apple in my hands, and I was able to give it to one of the Japanese loadmasters. And so they were out there for hours just parked, loading up all the relief aid. And, you know, he was just so thankful just for that apple. And I took a cool photo of him. And, you know, that was a good memory for me, just the international aspect and just to see the partnership that exists between the United States and the Philippines still. And it was definitely a rewarding mission. It was very sad what happened, but it was rewarding to be there, too.
Well, you know, I tell you, our next guest on Daily Mail is a well-known national speaker and author called Larry Wingate, and one of his main issues is, hey, look, stuff happens in life. It's going to happen, but it's what you do when it happens that makes a difference. So, obviously, the folks in the Philippines had no control over that tragedy. But did you get out in the field with these folks as well?
You know, I was able to talk to the people who were evacuated, and it was, you know, here's a good story. So where we were at the Philippine Air Force Base, we saw a lot of community cooperation. And what I mean by that is that the community rallied amongst itself to support the people who lost their homes or lost their family members. And the survivors, as they were coming into the airfield, they were going over to an area that was set up with clothing and medical attention and you know, cell phone minutes, whatever they needed. It was all set up, and it was all organized by the community. And the Philippine Air Force Base, the Spouses Club, put out the word, and every day we would see people from the community bringing in bags of rice and clothing and just setting it all up. And it was very touching to see that. But, you know, I believe the same thing happens here in our country, too. You know, for example, when Katrina happens, or, you know, when something like that happens, our community does the same thing. And
You know, in researching this and reading some of the stories as recently as coming out just a couple of days ago, I read a segment. There is a difference, though, in that to a great extent, we have resources in place and are able to help here in the United States when something like a Katrina happens. You know, there's, of course, the famous FEMA trailers, which, you know, maybe didn't work out so well. But in the Philippines, the bottom line is there just weren't those kinds of resources. So you literally have people whose home was wiped out and there's nothing but two walls standing that are now living under a tarp and sleeping on a piece of plywood just trying to get their life back together. Did you see any of those sorts of situations? Or?
I didn't personally see that, but members of my team did.
Okay.
So, you know, just listening to their stories when they were coming back, you know, from escorting the media down and bringing them back. It was very sad, you know, it was what you would imagine when there's complete devastation. You know, there were bodies. I think that was one of the tougher things to see the images of and to hear about, just all of the bodies that were there, being picked up and put into body bags. And when I was talking to some of the relief workers, they were telling me that it's an estimate of the number of dead, you know, for example, because maybe there's two people that are put into a body bag, not necessarily one because they didn't have enough or it was just what they could do, you know, quickly, or there's mass, you know, burial sites. And
I think they're doing that now, and I saw that they're discovering an average of 10 new fatalities every day out there, and that's to make the tragedy even worse. Obviously, you've got to move quickly. Those remains have to be buried rather quickly, or then you face another catastrophe with disease and some other issues spreading. So one thing that was interesting, two things, Stacey. You mentioned the Japanese, and one thing that really struck me about the tragedy that happened recently in Japan, where we had some interview with some military folks that went over there to help out, was the resiliency of the Japanese people. You know, very little whining, just kind of pick yourself up and go about it. Did you get a sense of being a country that just so recently experienced such a huge tragedy and now they're there helping their neighbors out? Did you get a sense of a particular bit of determination on their part because of that? Or?
Oh, definitely. It was touching. Like I said earlier, nobody was complaining. You know, nobody had any reason to complain. You were there to help those people. And no matter what country you came from or what your background was, everybody just pitched in and did something, did their part. And, I mean, I can even say that the people there in the Philippines, I mean, despite what had just happened to them, losing everything or losing family members, they were still just some of the kindest, most generous people that I've ever met. And, I mean, that was amazing to see, too. I guess I would struggle to think that we would be that way a lot of times when things happen here. So it was very humbling to see that happen.
But so often
it's
about perspective, and it's one thing to see it on television. It's another thing to actually be there on the ground. And hopefully most of us will never have the opportunity to find out in person. But after we take a little bit of break, I'd like to have you just talk about a concept I'd like to explore, given your experience, Stacy, is what was it like working in a country like the Philippines where, for all practical purposes, we've got a good relationship established over years historically,
mm-hmm.
versus what it was like in Afghanistan or Iraq. So if you could maybe compare and contrast those for us. This is American Warrior Radio, your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We'll be right back with Major Stacy Chaffron.
She's a good girl. It's crazy about Elvis. Loves horses. And her boyfriend, too.
My daddy served in the army. We lost his right eye, but he flew a flag out in our yard till the day that he died. He wanted my mother, my brother, my sister, and me to grow up and live happy in the land of the free.
If you want to discuss those who serve the red, white, and blue, dial 520-751-1041. If you want to support them, start with WoundedWarriorProject.org. Now, back to the American Warrior on 104.1 The Truth.
And we're back. Welcome back to American Warrior. This is your host, Ben Bueller Garcia. We're talking last segment with Major Stacy Chaffron. She is attached to the U.S. Transcom, Joint Enabling Capabilities Command, which is a mouthful, but basically they're the logistics folks of the Air Force, among other things. And Stacy was part of a 12-member team that was deployed to the Philippines in the aftermath of Typhoon Haiyan and Yolanda. And Stacy, we're talking a little bit about, on the past show, you had interviewed with us about your role in Afghanistan, going out into some of the villages, and particularly working with the women in Afghanistan, helping them, I don't know if the new concept is a good phrase, but helping them get them integrated into the government, and which I thought was just really intriguing, the challenge of taking what are traditionally Western democratic values out into some of those villages. And I'm just kind of curious if you can compare sort of the feel you had and the difference that were it might have been in Afghanistan with an organization, a country or people that have not always had good relationships or no relationships, maybe a better way to put it, with U.S. government or United States citizens as a whole, versus the Philippines, where there's more of a long tradition of support there.
Yep, we've had a long-standing partnership and friendship between the United States and the Philippines. We engage with them, on a regular basis. We have exercises, so there's that partnership and that training that's still ongoing, and people are very warm and inviting. Countless times they thanked us for being there. There's similarities and there's differences between the missions that, I've done over in Afghanistan and Iraq, versus having this chance to go over to the Philippines. I think people are people no matter where they are and what their background is. They want to make sure that their family is taken care of and that their children are okay and that they have food and water and shelter and medical care. So no matter where you are, people have those basic needs.
I saw
that in both locations. Mm-hmm.
Did you get a sense that in the Philippines you didn't have to spend the first part of the time convincing them that you actually were there to help them versus what might have been different in Iraq or Afghanistan? I mean, they kind of just knew that and they took it for granted?
Well, we were in the Philippines at the request of the government of the Philippines. So they invited us and we were there supporting the Department of State. And they were very welcoming, and we, military, we bring unique capabilities when we go to places that are completely devastated. So we have the engineers and the logistical equipment to help move debris or to help fix buildings or, clear the roadways and do stuff like that. So they welcomed our unique capabilities. And that's not to say that in the areas where we were in Afghanistan that they didn't welcome that either. It was an honor to help empower the women that I worked with over in Afghanistan and, to help give some hope to some of the children that we worked with. And it's just, they're just very different cultures and, very different history of what's happened with them.
Now, you talked a little bit about some of the tools that the our armed forces bring to the scenario here, and I think a lot of us, again, are very familiar with with the guns and the bombs and the planes and those sorts of things. But tell us a little bit more, if you can, about the types of like I said, the advantages that the unique advantages that the capabilities the military brings. I saw somewhere that the Navy task force that was there was able to generate or literally manufacture 700,000 gallons of clean water every single day.
That is
something
we
take for granted.
Yep. I mean, the USS George Washington strike group was there, and they had more than 6,000 people that were aboard their strike group and aboard or afloat. And they were making water, and it was being transported to the people in need. And you know, that's being in the Air Force. I've never had the chance to see that or know about that. So there was a lot of learning just on my part too. And you know, the media, we were trying to get them out so they could cover that and see. I mean, that's an amazing capability that we have in the U.S. military. That's just one example. Just our different type of aircraft. The Osprey, we're able, mm-hmm. the Marines Osprey was able to bring aid out into the remote locations. The roadways were destroyed. So airlift was pretty much the only way that we could get aid to some of these locations. And, it was a true partnership with the U.S. and the different agencies and our different international partners.
You know, in the past we've had guests on from the 12th Air Force who talked about the logistics involved in the tragedy down in Haiti, and just moving again, as you mentioned before, it's not just military aircraft, but you've got all these folks from other international agencies and other militaries and other countries coming in. I think in one case it said they even had, I can't remember, was some kind of rock star, movie star wanted to fly in and help the people. And they said, well, wait a minute, you know, we've only got space for so many planes. This was a little bit different in that you did have areas, like you said, you were in Manila, where things were relatively normal as far as the infrastructure there, correct?
Yep, exactly. But we still have those same issues. I mean, there's limited space in the areas that you need to go down and work in. The airfields are full of all these aircrafts. And the priority was to evacuate the people and get them out mm-hmm. of there and bring supplies in. So you're dealing with the same sort of challenges. I was actually at Davis Monthan when the incident in Haiti happened. So while I wasn't in Haiti, I understand and read up a lot about it. So very similar in the sense of what we're able to help do and provide.
Well, you mentioned the language barriers that you encountered with some of the military of other countries, and then perhaps maybe even the international media. How much of a challenge was that? I just happened to read that some of the rebuilding efforts that are going on, again, something we take for granted, like basic literacy, that when they go back to try and work with these people to rebuild their home, some of them may not be able to read, so they've got to, you know, modify everything so they're actually using pictures and diagrams to say, look, if mm-hmm. you rebuild this house the way your grandfather built it, it's going to get knocked down again, but if you rebuild it this way, you've got a better chance next time. But it all had to be done in picture form. How prepared did you feel you and your team were? Were there the resources there to deal with the language barrier?
So really, we didn't have too much of a problem with that there. That's another difference, you know, compared to my time when I was over in, like, Afghanistan. The people that I went out and talked to, they spoke English, in addition. So, I didn't really have that challenge. But I think what was happening when we were there in November was just moving people, moving equipment. And that, the stuff that you were just explaining about the rebuilding, you know, that's, wasn't really what we were doing at that point. That wasn't our focus. So I can imagine, though, that it's going to be a challenge. And you would have that anywhere, the language barriers or, you know, just trying to change the mindset of how things should be built or, you know, where they should be placed.
What, in a situation like this, who's in charge? I mean, obviously the Philippine government, it's their country. They've, you know, they're the final say, maybe, or do they hand that responsibility over to someone, or how does that work?
Nope. The Philippine government, they're the ones that have to initiate the request for the support. And so they did that through our government and the Department of State and USAID. That was the lead federal agency. And so we, the U.S. military, was there to support that. So we were there at the request of the Philippine government, and we stayed as long as they asked us to. And within a few weeks, we were able to release the military members, and what stayed behind were the NGOs or State Department personnel, USAID, because, you know, the mission of the military, we have to be ready and reset ourselves to go for the next mission that we may be called upon to do.
Now, Stacy, you were there 2 weeks?
Just about 2 weeks, yep.
And now coming back home to the United States, what was your sense? Mission accomplished? Obviously, there's a lot of work yet to do in the Philippines, but share with our listeners. So, I mean, you've been in some pretty remote, some pretty interesting situations, you know, among which are this situation in the Philippines. What were your thoughts coming back to the United States and just kind of looking around?
So we came back right after Thanksgiving, so just right at the start of our big holiday season. And I think it's just always what hits me is coming back and just realizing how wonderful our country is and how many opportunities we have and the resources available to us, whether it's food and nice homes and shelter, and just not to take any of that for granted. I personally, I don't think I was prepared for what I saw just in Manila on a daily basis. There's some definite challenges there with poverty and how people are able to live, and just talking to some of the local population, the amount of money that they even earn there, and just the disparity in their population. So it was tough. You know, I saw a lot of people and children living on the street, and that was just normal day-to-day life in Manila. So magnify that with all the people that were evacuated out of the hard-hit areas. That was hard, you know, and then you come back to the United States and, you know, we're in the hustle and bustle of the holiday season, and just helps, I think, refocus, at least in my mindset. So we really don't have very much to complain about on a daily basis.
Well, I tell you, when I sat down this Thanksgiving, I was made a point to be very thankful for folks like you that are separated from your families so that I could be with my family during the holidays. So have you had a chance to follow up at all with some of the personnel that had been over there, just to kind of get a sense of what their thoughts are coming back, their thoughts of being able to serve folks in that capacity versus a warfighter capacity, if you will?
Yeah, I have conversations like this with some of the other people that I work with. And I think everyone feels very similar to it. You know, they were honored to be able to go and serve. And I think we all just have kind of a similar mindset. You know, we go and do that, and then we come back to our country, and we're with our friends and family, and we just feel very grateful and very thankful for what we have. And, it's definitely an honor to be able to do what we do and represent the United States and go out there and do these kind of missions and, you know, help people however we can.
Do you have any information or what's ongoing over there with the United States military and the Philippines? I assume there's still some folks on the ground helping out, or do you know, is that wound down a little bit, or are things still, do we still have quite a few forces over there and will for a while? Do you know?
There's a U.S. embassy that's based there in Manila, so we do have that presence. And, you know, I'd imagine that what USAID and the NGOs are doing is going to take a long time to continue with that process. I mean, these people lost pretty much everything, so it's going to take a while for them to rebuild and figure out what their next plan is going to be. And just even little things like the children who lost their parents, you know, it was tough seeing that sort of thing too. We evacuated, there was, you know, aircraft that were bringing the children out of areas like that, and they had lost their families. So, I mean, what I'm curious to find out about is what happens to those orphans and, you know, if they're placed with family members, you know, in the Philippines, or if they're adopted out. I have my little list of things that I want to follow up on too, just the, because I'm curious about stuff like that too.
So many more stories to tell. And Stacy, we really appreciate you coming on the air here and sharing that information with us. Anything you want to leave our listeners with, either as far as what you're doing now or fun? I know you wanted to be back there because of the weather, but, you know, we do have an air show coming up, folks, where Davis Monthan was successful in securing an open house, I guess is the proper term, not an air show, but coming up in April. So maybe you can come out and handle the logistics for that.
That would be a lot of fun. I definitely miss seeing the aircraft and being around that. I just finished up an assignment at 14th Air Force, Vandenberg Air Force Base, where we have our West Coast launch mission for the first base. And So I've been away from the aircraft for a few years, but now I'm in Navy territory, so I see the Hornets flying around down there in Norfolk. And, you know, it's just, it's an honor to be part of the military, and however I can serve, I'm honored to do that.
Well, you know, Stacy, I'll just leave you. You might be able to use this, given your current office situation, but I remember the commander of the Navy Reserve Center here once, I was giving him a hard time about being just right outside the gate of Davis-Monthan, and he kind of shook his head and says, yeah. He says, it's so hard being in a Navy town full of Air Force people. So
yeah,
it all works out. We're all on the same side.
It does. Yep, we're all on the same team.
Well, Stacy, thank you for your service, and thanks for calling into American Warrior. Folks, I hope you've enjoyed this program. We're back here every Sunday at noon for American Warrior with another interesting guest like Stacy. And, Stacy, I hope you'll come back with us sometime soon.
Definitely. Thanks so much, Ben.
My pleasure. Folks, stay tuned. Coming up on Daily Mail, probably the most difficult discussion I will have had in my short radio career. Our guest is Larry Wingate, the pit bull of personal development. 5-6 best-selling books, 2 television series. This is a guy you're not going to want to miss. So stay tuned. Daily Mail coming right up after the commercial.